Last time we talked about the history of production of addictive substances in the American experience, and this time I'd like to talk about the history of consumption. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk just a little bit about the consumption of nicotine, and then quite a bit about the consumption of alcohol and its history, and then we'll talk about the consumption of other narcotics and drugs of various kinds. Let's start with just a few comments about cigarettes, which are nicotine delivery products. This graph shows the big picture. It's the per capita daily consumption of manufactured cigarettes in the U.S. starting at the beginning of the 20th century through 2004. Now, prior to the beginning of the 20th century, most nicotine in tobacco was consumed by chewed tobacco, snuff. But in the earliest 20th century, which really dramatically increased the consumption of nicotine, was the development of machines to produce cigarettes in industrial scale, which was late teen, early 20s, as I recall. And you can see that the consumption went off quite dramatically. It didn't happen all by itself. Of course, you had to sell the stuff. You had to make it seem like an attractive product. Actually, somewhat of a challenge in the case of cigarettes, unlike many addictive products, whose first use produces euphoria or some sort of pleasant experience. Typical first use of a nicotine-containing product is sort of nausea and coughing. So you have to add in a lot of marketing to make this seem like a cool product, which is what they did, and you can do it. You can also give away a lot of cigarettes for free, which is what they did during World War II and before and even after that period. And as long as you get a sufficient number of adolescents addicted who are likely to be long-term users, you can build a pretty good business plan out of that. Use of manufactured cigarettes continues to grow until the early 60s. I think the peak is 1963, at which time the average American, not the average smoker, but the average American consumed 11 or 12, somewhere between 11 and 12 cigarettes a day. So since not all, even then, not all Americans smoked cigarettes, it was about 60% of the total, it meant that most people who did smoke had a pack or day kind of habit. In 1960s, people were living in a great fog of tobacco smoke. Some of you are my age or older listening to this will remember sitting in cigarettes, smoke-filled airplanes or restaurants and so on. Because it was everywhere, and people were consuming enormous quantities of it. Now, there has been since that time a pretty gradual decline in American consumption of nicotine. It still represents one of the most significant public health problems faced by the United States. But there are encouraging signs. Now, hidden in that downward trend is a staggering amount of hard work. This is a problem that had to be attacked at every conceivable level. There had to be some sort of counterattack to the notion that cigarettes were cool. The manufacturers of cigarettes are spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year to convince you that this is a soothing, cool, safe product. And there needed to be some sort of advertising to counterbalance that. There needed to be a legal assault on the advertising claims. There needed to be a legislative assault to increase regulation, availability to minors and those kinds of laws. There's just lots of different things went into decreasing this legislation, the total use of nicotine in the U.S. And this battle is far from over. Seems likely that the tail of this bell-shaped curve will be fairly long. We will see in the next decade what happens now that the Food and Drug Administration is authorized to regulate tobacco products. My hope is that that will be one of the factors that leads to a further decrease in overall use. Notice that, however, it does seem like a classic epidemic. It's an epidemic that lasts a century and is responsible for millions and millions, tens and tens of millions of deaths. But it sort of matches your sensibility about what an epidemic looks like. It comes and gradually goes. Now, if the U.S. is on the downward slope of this classic bell-shaped epidemic curve, the rest of the world is not. That is, this is still a pretty popular item in global commerce, and cigarette usage in many parts of the world is still going up quite rapidly. And I think I showed you some of the public health consequences of that in an earlier segment. Now, and I'll just make one comment about how hard it is to sustain the downward trend in cigarettes sales. People worked very hard for a very long time, decades, to eliminate the subsidy of the production of tobacco in the United States. It used to be treated just like an ordinary crop, and you would subsidize its production at the federal level. And gradually, those funds were eliminated throughout the 1990s. But if you look in this next graph at tobacco subsidies by year, you'll see that in the first term of George W. Bush, tobacco subsidies returned to the tune of $500 billion, $500 billion of taxpayer money during the first 4 years of that administration went to subsidize the production of tobacco products. Now, I don't want to make a partisan comment about that. I don't think that's the point. The point I really want you to see here is that the public policy gains, victories that led to the decrease in tobacco consumption in America are all fragile. They're all reversible. And the forces who would like to see them reverse are still very active and out and about doing whatever they can to ensure their long-term viability as producers of what they consider to be useful products in the American marketplace. Okay, I think that's all I want to say about nicotine consumption. Obviously, we're just skimming here. Let's look at the big picture of alcohol consumption in American history. Here is the best estimates that I think that are out there of total consumption of alcohol in all alcoholic beverages per capita in gallons. And I want to look at different time periods here. In the pre-19th century and early years of the 19th century, consumption was very high, and I gave you some reasons why that might be. Last time, there were not really many alternative beverage choices that were safe to drink. It was universally acceptable to consume alcoholic beverages, and you're dominantly doing, really hard physical labor all day long outside, and need a pretty high caloric intake, and production of distilled spirits was one of the few ways to preserve over time the caloric value of some of the crops that you were raising. In the first half of the 19th century, however, consumption of alcohol declined precipitously. I mean, it just went down. It went down by almost 70%. And there are a number of factors that account for this. First is the emergence of alternative beverages. Tea and coffee, for example, almost single-handedly changed consumption practices at breakfast. it just eventually made more sense to people to consume a mild stimulant at breakfast to help you get going during the day rather than to take a central nervous system depressant like alcohol, in spite of the fact that that had been normative practice for hundreds of years. There were also changes in the nature of work that sort of matched that change in sensibility about how you get ready for your day. Less work was out of doors, and the emergence of different kinds of occupations that did not require that sort of caloric fortification for working hard all day changed people's sensibilities about beverage consumption. But you also have quite prominently during this period the temperance movement and 19th century revivalism, which are joined at the hip. Let me just say a bit about each of those. The 19th century evangelicals had enormous energy around the issue of alcohol consumption. I think if you took all of the sort of litmus test issues that concerned the Republican, the Christian right today, say abortion and Terri Schiavo and Second Amendment and what have you, all the issues, constellation of issues that they generate energy for the American right today, it would be substantially less than the energy you found in the 19th century in the Christian community about alcohol. It was the dominant issue. And in many parts of the Christian community, stopping drinking was the functional equivalent of getting saved. It was, when you came forward to accept Jesus, it was sort of a blurring of the line. Are you coming forward to accept Jesus, or are you coming forward to pledge not to drink alcohol anymore? And well, I have actually a pretty substantial affinity for 19th century evangelicals, probably, if I'm telling the truth today, substantially more affinity for 19th century evangelicals than I do for 20th century evangelicals. I think this is one of the points at which there was a clear weakness in their theological frame. They had a hard time, while they get pretty high marks for identifying the big problem. Alcohol was a big problem, as it is still. But their theological foundations failed to adequately distinguish between that sort of social issue from larger concerns. Now, a few words about the temperance movement over this period. Actually, let me move on to talk about the second half of the 19th century, where alcohol use, the influence of the temperance movements started to fade. And we don't have time to talk about all the reasons for that. Let me just mention two things. One was the waves of European immigration mid-century. You had lots of whiskey-loving Irishmen and beer-loving Germans, millions, immigrated to the United States where they took menial physical labor kinds of jobs. And they brought to that a certain sensibility about what you needed in order to be able to do that. You needed to fortify yourself to do that hard work, and that was associated with a certain drinking culture. You're also going to be dirt poor immigrants with not that many things that you can do for relaxation, and alcohol fit into that pattern as well. But you also had a pretty substantial changes in the temperance movement in the middle of the 19th century. I want to just briefly mention that because I think it'll have some implications for us today. the temperance movement began as a temperance movement, as a moderation movement. They wanted to encourage people to drink beer instead of whiskey, to drink, you know, things with low alcohol content rather than things with high alcohol content. It's really a moderation management kind of strategy. And over the course of time, that changed quite dramatically, so that the temperance movement, the center goal of the temperance movement wasn't moderation, but abstinence. And that kind of hardening of the goal, if you will, had some, I think, systemic sort of effects on the ethos of the movement, on its effectiveness. It became easier to think of them as extremists, which in American culture is always one of the ways to dismiss a movement. The other thing was that it moved gradually over time from a focus on voluntary compliance, on moral suasion, as they would call it, where they were trying to convince people to voluntarily stop consuming alcoholic beverages, to a movement that focused on government regulation. We want the government to solve this problem by enacting legislation, by criminalizing this behavior. And that really had a very profound effect on how the temperance movement was perceived over time, and ultimately reduced its effectiveness. One of the reasons for this is that the temperance movement, and this is, I think, for our purposes, a fairly important point, the temperance movement was not about helping addicted people. Let me just show you one quote from Justin Edwards, who is the head of the American Society for the Promotion of Temperance. This is what he said about the goals of the temperance movement. Our main object is not to reform inebriates. This is not about helping addicted people, he's saying. Rather, he says, it's to induce all temperate people to continue temperate by practicing total abstinence. Okay. It's not encouraging people to drink less, to drink drinks with less alcohol content. He's encouraging people who are abstinent to stay abstinent. And his solution for the addicted people, the drunkards, if not reformed, will die and the land will be free. Now, I don't think that comes across as very sensitive to the needs and concerns of alcoholics, does it? I mean, eventually you're going to die out. That's how we're going to solve the problem. You're going to die off. So the move from temperance to abstinence, from what they would have called moral suasion to government control, the movement away from attention to the suffering of individual addicted people to kind of ignoring their needs and concerns. And there was also kind of grandiosity of expectations, I think, that became a more and more prominent part of the temperance movement over time. I'll just give you one quote. This is getting ahead of ourselves just a little bit, but this is Billy Sunday's. Billy Sunday was a very prominent, probably the most prominent evangelist in America, early 20th century. This is what he said in 1920 on the passage of the Volstead Act. The Volstead Act was the implementing legislation for the 18th Amendment of the Constitution, which prohibited the production and sale of alcoholic beverages. This is his comment. The reign of tears is over. The slums will soon be only a memory. We will turn our prisons into factories and our jails into storehouses and corn cribs. Men will walk upright now. Women will smile and children will laugh. Hell will forever be rent. Now, even allowing for the sort of rhetorical flourishes that one might be inclined to allow evangelists, this is a really quite astonishingly grandiose expectation of what the outcome of prohibition might be. So for all these reasons, I think the you see a kind of fragility emerge in the temperance movement. Now, and you see that most prominently in the increase in alcohol consumption during this time period. After the influence of the temperance movement faded in the second half of the 19th century, you did have this gradual increase in alcohol consumption. And then quite dramatically, beginning in 1918, a significant decrease again in total alcohol consumption because of the enactment of the 18th Amendment of the Constitution in 1918. Now, the leaders of the temperance movement thought of this as the culminating achievement of a century's worth of effort, and I think it is true that there was a progression in the second half of the 18th century from towns going from wet counties going from wet counties to dry counties. The reality, of course, is they would go from wet counties to sort of damp counties. There was certainly plenty of alcohol consumed in counties that enacted legislation prohibiting the sale and consumption of alcohol. And eventually, whole states, beginning with Maine, many states voted to prohibit the sale of alcoholic beverages. And finally, the 18th Amendment. I think the reasons for the passage of the 18th Amendment are more complicated than that. There were two principal factors worth mentioning. One was World War One. At the advent of World War One, it became apparent that distilled alcohol was a strategically important military asset. You needed alcohol, you needed distilled alcohol to produce acetone. And from acetone, you made cordite, which was the explosive used in World War One, the replacement for gunpowder. And so there was a significant military rationale for prohibiting the sale and consumption of alcohol as beverages. I think that played a pretty substantial role in the passage of the 18th Amendment of the Constitution. There was also another important piece of the puzzle was that one of the reasons not to prohibit alcohol sale had been removed. The government had been making a substantial amount of money by taxing alcohol production. Prior to this time period, most federal income was from excise taxes, not income taxes. But in 1916, if I remember correctly, the 16th Amendment of the Constitution was passed, which established the federal income tax system that we are familiar with today. And this was intended to provide a more stable source of income for the federal government. And in the 1920s, it was a time of expanding incomes that seemed like a pretty reasonable thing to do. And about this time, it didn't seem like you needed those alcohol production taxes quite as much as you used to, because you could rely on this new sort of stream of income from income taxes. So those factors all combined led to the passage of the 18th Amendment in 1918, and then the implementing legislation, the Volstead Act, in 1920. The prohibition period lasted almost 14 years, and you know, in the popular imagination, it's associated with a dramatic increase in crime. Of course, you're criminalizing behavior that had been legal for generations, so. Sure, it was increased. There was a whole lot of crime generated by this legislation. It also, I think, led in popular imagination to a kind of glamorization of alcohol that had fairly significant consequences later on. The Volstead Act had a differential impact on different kinds of users of alcohol, mostly because it had exemptions for different kinds of alcohol. Let me just give three quick examples. For example, alcohol that you owned prior to the enactment of the legislation wasn't covered by the restrictions of the Volstead Act. The Yale Club famously went out and purchased 14 years worth of alcohol so that its clients, its customers, would be completely unaffected by the passage of the Volstead Act. And they were pretty prescient, seems to me, in picking 14 years worth of supply. There was also an exemption for alcohol produced for personal consumption, so there was quite an expanded interest in home brewing technology. It's not, don't need to be a rocket scientist to brew home whiskey. It's fairly easily done. And so there's a lot of that picked up that probably is completely under the radar in terms of total production estimates, although people try to make estimates for that kind of thing. And finally, there was an exemption for alcohol produced and consumed for medical purposes. This turned out to be about as effective as legalizing medical marijuana. All of a sudden, you see this enormous, really epidemic in medical problems that are of the kind that will get you a prescription for marijuana. And in the 20s, during Prohibition, it was associated with a very significant increase in the number of products in the market that are the kind we, I'll show you some examples later of alcohol-containing products that were marketed principally for their medical benefits. You could put 40 to 60% alcohol in the bottle and throw in herbs and spices of some kind that you claim have medical benefit, and all of a sudden you have a product that's perfectly legal under the Volstead Act. And there was a lot of that. And there were also a lot of unintended consequences of the Volstead Act. Myself, I think that it sort of set up American culture for the epidemic of amphetamine addiction, which was to follow the Prohibition period, and the increase in alcohol use that inevitably was going to follow this period. It also, during the last part of the 19th century, there was an emergence of a alcohol addiction treatment culture. There were what were called inebriate asylums, where people could go to get treated. Now, treatments were not particularly effective, but still there was an emerging infrastructure in American culture to respond to the needs of alcoholics. And that was pretty much decimated by the Prohibition period. All of a sudden, to need such services was to admit to a crime. So most of those institutions went out of business and had to be the whole infrastructure for treatment of people struggling with alcohol addiction had to emerge anew after the Prohibition period. Now, when Prohibition was repealed in 1933, alcohol consumption went up quite rapidly to a level that exceeded the level of alcohol consumption prior to the enactment of the 18th Amendment of the Constitution. This graph only shows consumption through 1970, but while consumption has been volatile in the years since then, in fact, during the 1980s, consumption of distilled spirits went down pretty steadily during the 1980s and the first half of the 1990s, but it sustained roughly this level. I'd say in the post-prohibition era, alcohol consumption has gone up fairly steadily on average through that entire period, to a level now significantly in excess of the level just prior to the enactment of prohibition. I just want to add one kind of footnote to this chart I've been looking at. We've been looking at total alcohol consumption, average gallons per year per person, which is not at all the same as if we were looking at, say, number of people addicted to alcohol or number of people with alcohol problems. Most of the consumption, unlike consumption of nicotine, where you can make the assumption, I think, that all use is harmful use, That assumption doesn't work very well with alcohol. In fact, most consumption of alcohol may not be associated with negative consequences of any kind. You know, if you have a beer with dinner a couple times a week, I'm not convinced that there are any sort of negative consequences to that behavior. So when alcohol consumption went down dramatically during different historical periods, I'd suggest that it doesn't necessarily mean that the problems created by alcohol went down. Even during Prohibition, of course, consumption of alcohol did not go down to zero. People who are addicted to alcohol are going to do whatever they need to do to get their alcohol. And that was the case throughout this entire period. Now, let's turn our attention to other drugs and talk about, I want to say a little bit about cocaine and then something about opiates and something about amphetamine. Prior to the 20th century, cocaine, opiates, amphetamine were completely unregulated products. I mean, they were available universally, every drugstore in America. There was no social stigma associated to their use. There was no legal consequences to using it. Here, for example, is an advertisement for cocaine tooth drops, instantaneous cure for toothaches, price 15 cents. The very small print has a date, 1885, on this. And, you know, if you have a toothache in 1885, you don't have aspirin, you don't have acetaminophen, other analgesics that we use now. And cocaine is not a bad analgesic under those circumstances, and was widely used. Notice the picture of happy children playing with Lincoln Logs. It was not a stigmatized product in any way. There was also in this period a, this is prior to the Harrison Drug Act of 15, I can't remember. There was quite a number of coca wines. This was wines with cocaine added to it. Kind of a, what do we call these now, energy drinks. This is sort of Red Bull with a bit of a kick to it. Wines with cocaine leaf extract added. And they had a very popular, the most popular brand in Europe and also a very popular brand in the United States was Vin Mariani. They had a series of advertisements, popular advertisements with endorsements from various famous figures. This one from the Pope awards gold medal in recognition of benefits received from Vin Mariani for body, brain, and nerves. It was not quite a medical product, but it was sort of good for you. Increased vigor and stamina and helped in, you know, all kinds of ways. There were many, many examples of this kind of product that were popular on the American market. The founder of Coca-Cola was in this business prior to marketing Coca-Cola, but he, as I understand it, was marketing a product to compete with Vin Mariani, an alcoholic beverage that contained coca leaf extract that contained cocaine. And when that became legally problematic, switched to an extract reputed to have less cocaine in it, or no cocaine in it, in the company's view, and substituted caffeine in its place. So you have less of a hit, but still a little bit of a chemical stimulant. So cocaine is pretty widely in use in the U.S. Until the early regulation, 19th century regulation, I'm sorry, early 20th century regulations on cocaine and opiates. Opiates were also very common. Here is one of the more popular sort of, I forgot what they call these now, but they're these were medicinals. They were, you know, syrups that were good for you no matter what kind of problem you have. This one, Paregoric, was 46% alcohol and 1.3 grains of opium per fluid ounce. Notice the label on the back of the bottle, which gives appropriate dosages down to 5 days old. So they're just kind of good for everybody kind of things. If you're you have insomnia, they help you sleep. If you sleep too much, it'll help you stay awake. If you have aches and pains of any kind, whatever bothers you, Paragoric is the stuff that's going to help you out. And this was not the only way in which opiates were marketed. The raw opium, the two substances that are most psychoactive in raw opium are codeine and morphine, and those purified products were also widely available in the U.S. Here's a marketing piece for Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup for children who are teething, and it contained 65 milligrams of morphine per fluid ounce. Now, if your child is teething and it's crying and you know, there's not that much stuff that you can do for this kid. You take a little of this morphine and put them on the tooth. The kid probably stops crying. It's like a medical miracle. Who wouldn't want to have some of this in their house? Widely used. Now, it's possible to take morphine and make it more potent. By acetylating it, for those of you who remember your organic chemistry, probably not many of you. And this was done in the early 20th century to create heroin. Bayer Pharmaceuticals was, I think, the major player here and produced heroin in very large quantities. Heroin is not a natural product. It's a chemically modified form of heroin. It's really a heroin delivery device. It's maybe 1.5-2 times as potent as heroin itself because it facilitates transport of the substance heroin into the brain. Here it's marketed as a cough suppressant. There was a period of time during which Bayer Pharmaceuticals marketed heroin as a cure for morphine addiction. One, as we'll talk about next time, of a number of examples of people marketing one addictive substance as a solution to the addiction to a different addictive substance. Turns out to be tragically fairly common. A few comments about amphetamine. Here's my favorite amphetamine example. This is something that would have been in the seat back in front of you if you were on an American World Airways flight in the late 1940s. There were some things that you could purchase during flight at cost. You could buy alcohol. You could buy cigarettes. So there's plenty of addictive products available on your flight. But some things they gave away for free, including chewing gum, toothbrushes, Benzedrine inhalers, and Kleenex. Now, which of these doesn't belong? Kleenex, chewing gum, and Benzedrine, a form of amphetamine. Well, to modern sensibilities, it just doesn't make sense to be giving away amphetamine inhalers. This is what an amphetamine inhaler looked like. It was a little cardboard tube with caps on each end, and inside was a little paper a wick that had been soaked in amphetamine solution. You could pop off the two caps on the ends and take a puff on the inhaler and get a Benzedrine. Amphetamine was an effective bronchial dilator, very helpful to asthmatics, and some people on long airline flights probably smoking all the smoke they were smoking found it helpful to have a bronchial dilator. So it was a helpful product at the time, but it turned out people figured out very quickly that instead of taking a little puff on this tube, you could take the wick out of the tube and chew on that for a while and get a pretty sizable hit of amphetamine. You could take several tubes. They're so cheap, they're giving them away for free on the airline, get really as much amphetamine as you could tolerate. And just so you don't think that methamphetamine is a new product in the American experience, just let me show you one ad for methamphetamine from the late 1940s, at which time it was marketed as an appetite suppressant. This is an advertisement that was run in medical journals. With methadrine, she can happily refuse. And meth turns out to be an effective appetite suppressant. It doesn't, however, turn out to be a very effective long-term weight loss strategy. And it does have all these very disturbing side effects, namely addiction. Now, let me just... I could go on and on with this stuff, but let me just see if there aren't some general conclusions to make about consumption of addictive substances in the American experience. The first is, I think, pretty obvious, is that addictive substances have been part of American culture for a long time. There is no sort of drug-free period there. And we have always lived in a kind of chemical soup. Now, we're not unique in that regard, but if you the closer you look at the consumption of mood-altering substances, you realize that there isn't any aspect of culture that's free from the influence of addictive substances. We have now, and always have been, living in a kind of mood-altering chemical soup. I think, well, it might not be entirely apparent from the data I've shown you, that alcohol seems to be the stable baseline for American culture. Alcohol is the melody, if you will, in America's symphony of addiction. It's going to be the drug of choice for addicts. It's cheap, readily available, was so even when it was illegal. Whereas most other addictive substances follow more classic epidemiological, you know, bell-shaped curve. So in the late 60s, for example, you have this experience with LSD, where you have huge increases, huge increase in awareness at the public level, and then a gradual decrease over time. And that'll be followed by club drugs, and that'll be followed by meth. And there'll always be something to kind of punctuate the bigger picture baseline, which is formed by alcohol consumption. Now, the third thing that's, I think, worth mentioning here is that whilst the consumption of some addictive substances follows a predictable epidemiological pathway. It becomes popular and then it becomes unpopular. It doesn't mean that the number of people who are addicted follows that kind of pathway. In fact, what it probably means is that there's a great number of people who are at a baseline addicted to alcohol, and then add to that over time, when it's popular, I'll do LSD. A little bit later, when it's popular to do meth, I'll do meth. Now, there are certainly people who are addicted to just meth or just LSD or other kinds of things. But polydrug abuse is far more common. And when you're thinking about ministry strategies or social policy for that matter, it's important not to confuse decrease in consumption of a particular substance with a decrease in the problem of addiction. It may just mean that people are moving from one addictive substance to another addictive substance. Okay, we could talk a lot more about this. I want in the next segment to talk about, again, focus on the context in which we're going to be working here, give you a sense of how the response to people struggling with addictions has changed over time in American culture. I think it's a pretty interesting story, and we'll get to that in the next segment.